This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on this 29th day of July 2010. Today I'm talking to Tom Secker, a researcher in the UK who has been looking into the intelligence connections behind the Al-Qaeda war on terror facade. Mr. Secker, thank you for coming on today.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, I understand you wanted to come on the program to set the record straight on some inaccuracies that float through the quote-unquote truth movement about the role of Emad Salem in the WTC 1993 bombing. And I believe you encountered the Corbett Report through one of my videos online in which I presented a selection from the Emad Salem informant tapes. Is that correct?
I've been a reader of your work for some time, and I saw your documentary about Al-Qaeda several months ago. And it was more that video was what motivated me to get in touch with you. I mean, I've been following your work for a while.
I see. All right. So, of course, WTC 1993 is something that I've touched on a few times now in various videos that I've done, but it's not something that I've devoted enough detail to, because it is an extremely complex plot. So obviously there's more to this than I'm able to usually get across in a short YouTube video. So I don't know if you'd like to go back to the origin of the plot or to concentrate on Salem, Emad Salem in particular, but why don't you pick this story up where you think it will be best for the listener?
Well, I mean, the most straightforward thing is to deal with Salem first. I mean, he's widely described as being, you know, FBI informant that bombs the World Trade Center, built the bomb that was used on the World Trade Center. And that is kind of true, but kind of not true. The story is considerably more complicated than that headline would necessarily have you believe. He actually was an informant for the FBI on three separate occasions. So if I just sort of give you a rundown of the Salem story, then it will probably make things clearer. He was a former Egyptian army officer. He served in the 70s and 80s. He may have been as highly ranked as a lieutenant colonel, but he may have been boasting about that. He was reputedly a bit of a braggart, a bit of a blowhard. He comes to the U.S. in 1987. He's like a lot of immigrants. He has dreams of a better life for himself, better life for his family. He is first recruited by the FBI in 1988. They want him to inform against KGB and Russian Mafia in New York. This doesn't really go anywhere because the FBI doesn't really trust Salem. They think he might be a double agent still working for Egyptian intelligence. So the relationship doesn't last very long. Salem goes away. He works in several menial jobs. He works at Stock Boy, cab driver. He worked low-level security for a couple of apartment stores. He ends up as a sort of in-house detective or security man at the Woodward Hotel. He's re-recruited by the FBI in August 1991, again, to inform on Russians. They were concerned with the Berlin Wall coming down, with the Soviet Union collapsing, that mobsters and KGB spies and what have you, that they'd be looking for a new base of operations, and New York would be an obvious place for that to happen. So he informs on the Russians. He develops a very good relationship with his handler, a Texan woman called Nancy Floyd, apparently very loyal and very diligent FBI caseworker. One day in 1991, he says to Nancy Floyd, "There are more dangerous people out there. You know, I mean, I'm informing on these Russians, but there are more dangerous people in New York that I know about." And he names her the blind sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman. And he says, the blind sheikh and his followers are, you know, more worthy of following than the KGB and the Russian mob. So Nancy Floyd, she's a little maybe out of her depth on this. She calls in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is this multi-agency group. They have them all over the place now, but this was the original one, the inaugural one in New York. And they have police, FBI, State Department, immigration. They're all working together. And this is where Salem meets Lou Napoli and John Antichev, who is the guy he's heard talking to on the recordings later on. And they become his sort of co-handlers, and he starts infiltrating the Blind Sheikh's group and informing on them. And he quits his job at the hotel. They cover his salary. They pay him, I think it was $500 a month at that time. But the deal is he is a pure intelligence asset. He's not wearing a wire. He's not expected to testify in court. He's, you know, never going to be a witness. He is just there to give them information in secret. However, both Andrzejew and Napoli are very busy men. They don't have time to debrief him. So, and because his relationship with Nancy Floyd was good, it turned out that she was often the one who would actually meet him late at night. She would talk to him. She would fill out the 302s, saying what he'd found out, what information he'd got. So he reports that the blind sheikh and his followers, who are a sort of, they're a mixture of miscellaneous Egyptians and veterans of the Soviet-Afghan War. Salem finds out that they have a sort of vague plot in mind to do with Jewish locations. They're looking at bombing, I don't know, jewelry stores and synagogues, that sort of thing, in New York. And he starts helping them gather materials to build a bomb to do this. This is what he's actually later referring to on the tapes. He's not really referring to an explicit bomb plot to bomb the World Trade Center. It was just he was involved in getting the materials together for them. So, meanwhile, there's a new supervisor comes in at the Joint Terrorism Task Force, a guy called Carson Dunbar. He decides he doesn't trust Salem. You know, I mean, the FBI has never been entirely sure about Salem up until this point. Dunbar also decides he can't trust Nancy Floyd either. So he sacks Salem. He orders them to sack Salem and eventually puts Floyd through this very, very lengthy and brutal sort of internal investigation where she's accused of all sorts of things, from everything from having an affair with Salem to fiddling her expenses, none of which is true, but it was a sort of punishment. I mean, exactly why that happened isn't really clear. So Salem was actually sacked by the FBI in the summer of 1992, and it isn't until 6-7 months later that the World Trade Center is actually bombed. And while there was an idea in this group floating around about bombing the World Trade Center at that point, it wasn't any kind of formalized, explicit plot that was going on. So like I say, to say that Salem built the bomb that was used on the World Trade Center isn't exactly true. He was involved with the group, very much so, and did some incriminating things, and potentially some criminal things, as this plot was developing. But it isn't a case of, you know, he built a bomb and then a week later someone else drove it to the World Trade Center and set it off. There is a passage of time in between that is often overlooked, I think, it would be fair to say. And in that time, that's when Ramzi Youssef turns up, and he was the one who actually built the bomb that they used, that they loaded into the van and drove to the World Trade Center tower and blew the thing up.
I do understand that interpretation, but to be fair, it's from the recording itself, the way that he phrases it is very much leading in the direction of this was the bomb that was actually used in the bombing, when he says, I don't think that because we was start already bombing, building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center, which seems to indicate a bomb that was actually used, when we know that the actual bomb was in fact built by Ramzi Youssef, is that right?
Yes. I mean, we've got to be careful here, because obviously Imad Salem is speaking in slightly broken English, so it is a little unclear whether we're talking about the same bomb or whether we're talking about he helped them put... I mean, one thing that is possible is that he was helping them put the sort of detonator, that part of the bomb, together, but that the main charge, the actual sort of explosive, the dangerous part, was what was put together by Ramzi Youssef. So you could say, potentially, that they both contributed to the construction of this bomb. And that may indeed be what he's saying. But also on the tapes, he does say that at the end of the recording that, you know, ultimately it was built somewhere else, that this bomb was, that the actual bomb that was used was built somewhere else. He implies that. So it is a little uncertain as to exactly how far it had got at the point that Ramzi Youssef came into it. But as I say, the main charge of the bomb was this urea nitrate fuel oil concoction that was very much of Ramzi Youssef's design. But perhaps this is, getting a little bogged down in the details because, as I say, the point is, Salem was involved in this group. He certainly did some things that were incriminating while he was involved with them. He is theoretically a criminal because of that. But, of course, because he was an FBI informant, that doesn't count. And perhaps more significantly than that, after the World Trade Center was bombed at the end of February 1993, Salem was re-recruited for a third time by the FBI. I think perhaps they realized that they'd let go their best shot of infiltrating this plan and stopping it, or possibly something else. But they re-recruit him, and this is where we get the Bridges and Tunnels plot, the New York Landmarks plot from. And in that role, Salem was actually wearing a wire. He was recording his conversations with the blind sheikh and with the various members of the group that were planning to blow up the bridges and tunnels. And he was also obviously wearing a wire as he was talking to his handlers. This is where we get the recordings from. But it was one of the contentions of the defense lawyers in the case for the bridge and tunnels plot, the New York Landmarks plot, that Salem was effectively a provocateur, that it was his idea that he was putting the suggestions to them for targets and for methods and, you know, the actual details that turned a kind of general criminal intent in these people into something that was actually prosecutable, something you could take to court and say, look, they went through these steps in order to prove that they were terrorists. So it does remain a little unclear as to quite how far Salem went in the World Trade Center bombing, in the plan, and how much of the bomb he actually constructed. The tapes aren't entirely clear.
No, well, they certainly aren't, but then let's take a little bit closer look at that plot itself and how it began and then how it unfolded, and what role the blind sheikh may have had in this, and then what role El Said Nosair might have had in this, and how that plot developed after he then left the employ of the FBI for that brief period when the bomb actually was constructed.
Well, okay, the blind sheikh, this is Omar Abdel Rahman. He is an Egyptian. He was the head of the Islamic group in Egypt, which is one of the two sort of main splinter groups of the Muslim Brotherhood. The others, Ayman Zawahiri's Islamic Jihad. He was a mentor for bin Laden. He helped raise funds, and he was recruiting volunteers and giving speeches, and generally he was one of these people who was whipping up young, potentially radical Muslims so that they would go and join the Mujahideen and go and fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. He traveled to the US various times in the late 1980s. We're talking 85, 86, through to 89. He was in and out of the country, again, raising funds.
And where did he get the visas to do that?
Well, through CIA agents who were posing as consular officials in, I think, Egypt and Sudan. This isn't the famous one in Jeddah that Michael Springman talks about. A similar thing was going on in other embassies and consular offices in other countries. So you could say he was sponsored by the CIA. It's not clear if he was ever actually recruited directly as an informant or anything. This is one of the mysteries, but he was certainly to some extent sponsored by them. They were tacitly, or perhaps more directly than that, acknowledging what he was doing, approving of what he was doing, and using this as part of the CIA's whole, you know, Operation Cyclone, which was funding and arming the Mujahideen and trying to destroy the Soviet Union through them. So he is arrested in 1989 in Egypt. He's placed under house arrest. They've had a long struggle with quote-unquote Islamic terrorism, but certainly forms of Islamic militancy and politically involved Muslims in Egypt for a very, very long time. So this was part of it's a policy that I suppose began with the assassination of Sadat. After that, you had a real crackdown in Egypt internally on people involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, people involved with the Sheikh's Islamic group and with Islamic Jihad. Zawahiri himself was imprisoned for several years and tortured. which may well have contributed to him being the radical that he now appears to be. So when the Blind Sheikh was imprisoned, this was part of this this crackdown, ultimately. And he stays in Egypt under house arrest for the best part of 12 months. Then he escapes and he comes to America, again on a CIA-sponsored visa. This policy seems to have continued. The fact that he was arrested in Egypt and therefore on a terrorist watch list in America didn't seem to mean a thing to them. They just, again, granted him the visa.
And it's important to note that an intelligence source told the Boston Herald in 1993 that a CIA investigation found that the agency was partly culpable for the World Trade Center bombing itself because of their aid to the Blind Sheikh.
Oh, I mean, certainly. And this is one of the things that needs to be declassified, really. This is something that people should be pushing for, is... I don't know the exact status of that internal CIA report, whether it was the Office of Inspector General or not. I don't think the Boston Herald actually said whether it is, but I'm assuming this is an Office of the Inspector General report, like the one that they had for the Bay of Pigs and the one that was declassified recently to do with the interrogation of the 9/11 suspects and all of that. That report is sat somewhere in a CIA office, and we're not allowed to see it, even though... it appears to say the CIA were partly responsible for the bombing of their own country. That is of sufficient importance that it should really be declassified and should be made public. And it isn't. And that's, I think, a sad indictment. I mean, we're talking about nearly 20 years ago that bomb went off.
Absolutely, yes, and perhaps not surprising to people who have followed this, but so I guess the Blind Sheikh's role in this is somewhat up in the air, I guess, but Peter Lance, I believe, has made a comment in recent years that that he would say that the head of Al-Qaeda is not Osama bin Laden, but the Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman.
Well, at that point... certainly in the period that we're talking about, sort of 1985 to 1995, I mean, you've got to remember the Blind Sheikh was arrested in America in 94, I think, as part of the whole Bridges and Tunnels plot, and was eventually tried and convicted for seditious conspiracy, which is some, you know, Civil War era thing where you apparently are planning to overthrow a government. So since then, it is hard to see how anyone could be the head of an organization that strongly when they're sat in a maximum security prison cell.
Right. To be clear, I think Peter Lance was referring to that period, obviously, when he was not in jail.
But, yeah, you're right to bring this up, because the Blind Sheikh played a key role in the taking over of the Al-Khifa office in New York, which is ultimately what an awful lot of this revolves around. In 1989, Abdullah Azzam and Osama bin Laden apparently have some kind of falling out and disagreement. Abdullah Azzam wants to use the Mujahideen as a means of protecting the state of Afghanistan and turning it into the caliphate, the Islamic State, and from there we'll say, you know, it will spread out from there, kind of thing. And Osama bin Laden has no interest in this. He wants to use the Mujahideen as a kind of international Islamic special forces who will go off and fight in any country that needs them. and for what it's worth, the CIA seem to have thrown their hat in the ring with bin Laden on this occasion, because behind bin Laden were the Egyptians, were Zawahiri, were the Blind Sheikh. They were very much in agreement with, or perhaps the progenitors of the idea, that's what the Mujahideen should be seeking to do next. And that fits in far better with what the CIA would want at that point than, you know, to them, the battle in Afghanistan was over. There was bigger battles to be won in Central Asia, in the Balkans, and we'll get to some of that. So when the Blind Sheikh comes to New York, this is shortly after Abdullah Azzam has actually been killed in a car bombing in Afghanistan. But some people, quite plausibly, blame on bin Laden, or if not bin Laden, someone working on behalf of bin Laden or Zawahiri. And shortly after the Blind Sheikh arrives in New York, we have another murder of Mustafa Shalabi. Now, Shalabi was the imam of the Al Farouk Mosque, which is where the Al-Kifa Refugee Center was based. He was also one of the men who incorporated the Al-Kifa organization back in 86-87. And this was a very important place. You know, there was a lot of money going through this, not just because the CIA were apparently using it to funnel money to the Mujahideen, but because there were what wealthy Muslims there are, a lot of them live in New York, and therefore were making donations. You know, wealthy Saudis and so on were making donations through the Al-Kifa, again, to help the Mujahideen. So it was a very important asset in a lot of ways. And it appears that the murders of Abdullah Azam and Mustafa Shalabi were a kind of coup, if you like, within, let's call it Al-Qaeda, whereby bin Laden and the Egyptians were taking over from the sort of Afghan-Pakistan orientated Abdullah Azam and Mustafa Shalabi. And that this was probably in some ways backed and certainly approved of by the CIA, because this relationship continued, as we know.
Well, absolutely. The CIA, it's alleged, used the Al-Kifa Refugee Center as a way of conduiting funds to Hekmatyar in Afghanistan, who was, of course, the Afghani rebel of choice of the CIA back at that time.
Well, and there is a slight diversion here between what the CIA were doing and what the ISI were doing. During the Afghan War, the ISI were primarily concerned with the Afghans within Afghanistan, the Islamic resistance within Afghanistan that existed prior to the CIA even getting involved. I mean, they were sort of already engaged in a civil war against the Soviet-backed communist government in Afghanistan in 77-78. And the ISI and the Saudis, but largely the ISI, they were the ones who were really directing that part of the war. In terms of the international fighters, the so-called Afghan Arabs, the ones who were being recruited from everywhere from, you know, Chechnya to New York to the Philippines, that was what the CIA were primarily involved with. That's what their concern really was. And so perhaps it is inevitable that after the war finishes, those in Afghanistan weren't concerned with fighting anymore. But the ones who'd come from wherever, Malaysia or somewhere, were far more likely to think this adventure has to continue. And therefore someone like bin Laden and Zawahiri, they're going to recognize this and realize there's something we can do with these people here.
Now, to be clear, you're talking about what really happened, but the official line is that the CIA was not funding the Arab Afghans. They were only funding the Afghanis.
Yes, but, I mean, that clearly wasn't true.
Yes, right.
because, I mean, the ties are too close, and one figure we haven't even got into yet is Ali Mohammed, who is involved in this almost from start to finish. He informally founded the Al-Kifa Center in New York before Mustafa Shalabi came along. He trained many of the people who were involved in the World Trade Center plot. I don't know if he ever actually met Ramzi Youssef. This is another point of some mystery as to whether he ever met Ramzi Youssef or had anything to do with him. But he was certainly around this group, and he was training people in the Al-Kifa Center, and he was taking training manuals from he was a U.S. Army officer, as you
know. Yeah, he was at Fort Bragg, he was an FBI
informant. Fort Bragg, and, yeah, well, and he became an FBI informant after he left the U.S. Army. So in the period that we're specifically talking about, when the murder of Shalabi took place, from there sort of through to the World Trade Center bombing, Ali Mohammed was an FBI informant, and yet he was training these people. He trained El-Sayed Nozair, who was another member who incorporated he was involved sort of in the founding of the Al-Kifa Center and the running of the Al-Kifa Center. He was a follower of the Blind Sheikh. He was a member of the Islamic group.
But Tom, we know from Peter Lance that just gee whiz, shucks, the combined forces of all the U.S. intelligence just couldn't figure this out, and that there was this Al-Qaeda spy working for them.
Well, that is probably untrue again, because, I mean, Peter Lance's narrative essentially says that this was bin Laden's master spy. He was a man loyal to the Islamist cause, if you like. But so many of his actions don't really indicate that. In that, I mean, for one thing, he married an American woman who he is still married to today, and who, certainly according to the interviews in Lance's book, was in love with him, and he was apparently in love with her. This sits somewhat ill at ease with this picture of a man who was so dastardly and so deceptive and so talented at spycraft that he managed to work for two different intelligence agencies in America and for the US Special Forces. I mean, it doesn't really add up as a narrative to me.
It adds up just about as much as the P-TECH story and the fact that Al-Qaeda managed to implant their back door into the offices of, the NORAD and the White House and the FBI and the FAA and all
exactly.
of those agencies.
I mean,
right.
The question we've really got to ask here is who's penetrating who? Who has the human intelligence capacity to run a covert operation on this scale? Is it a bunch of, idealistic Saudi Arabians like Osama bin Laden and slightly crazed Egyptians like Ayman Zawahiri? Or is it the CIA, who we know through past operations have been running this sort of thing since, the dawn of the CIA? The likelihood is it's going to be the agency. And so then we get the rather difficult question of, is there even a separate organization, Al-Qaeda, that can be identified in that way, that is actually sort of penetrated in the same sense that they did in the Cold War, where you have the Soviet Union, then you have a specific target, an identifiable target. Is Al-Qaeda the same sort of thing, or is it in fact something that has been helped, generated in various ways, as a kind of project that can then be monitored and manipulated and used to try and achieve various aims? I mean, you've probably come across, and certainly I imagine some of your readers will as well, a statement by Graham Fuller, who was deputy director of the CIA's National Council on Intelligence. They produced the National Intelligence Estimates. And he said, this policy of, the policy of guiding the evolution of Islam worked so well in Afghanistan that they wondered if the same doctrines could still be used, could carry on after the end of the Cold War, after the end of the Soviet-Afghan War. Could that doctrine be continued? And it appears that it was, because we're not just talking about the blind chase in Ali Mohammed. These days we have... There are a dozen names that we could pluck out of the air quite easily. People... Saeed Sheikh, the guy who supposedly, on behalf of the ISI, was transferring money to Mohammed Atta, whoever Mohammed Atta was, and whatever Mohammed Atta was. And he was also, reportedly, recruited by MI6. And this is in 1999, 2000. This is several years after the World Trade Center bombing. This is after, even, the African Embassy bombings. So this policy continued. This isn't something that we just tried out in Afghanistan, then it finished, then, these people that we had once sponsored went away and started doing dastardly things. This is something that it continued throughout the 1990s and probably still goes on today.
That's absolutely right, and perhaps we should flesh out something that I find interesting is the frequency with which British intelligence is implicated with much of this. We have Webster Tarpley having made the assertion that Al-Zawahiri is in fact working for British intelligence, and he has some of that in his 9/11 synthetic terror book. And we had John Loftus was on Fox News a few years ago to say that the supposed mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, Harun Rashid Aswat, was British intelligence. So it seems to be of great frequency that British intelligence is raised in these types of connections. But what have you been able to uncover in those regards?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought up Aswat, because this is a curious case. Exactly what Aswat is not at all clear, because one question would be, if he was, as Loftus maintains, some kind of double agent, working for MI6 while simultaneously potentially being involved in the London bombings, then why has he now been abandoned by the intelligence services? Because he an arrest warrant was issued by the US due to this sort of long-standing issue of him supposedly trying to set up a terrorist training school in Oregon, of all places. Why, if he was an MI6 double agent, why is that arrest warrant in force? Why is he being extradited? Although, whether or not he's actually been extradited is not at all certain. But this happened after the Loftus interview. So, there is a possibility that ASWAT has absolutely nothing to do with the London bombings, and also, simultaneously, there is a reasonably strong possibility that he had nothing to do with MI6 either. John Loftus may actually just be wrong about this, because, like I say, the story doesn't add up after the point at which that interview was given, because ASWAT now seems to have been, you know, scooped up and stuck in a hole somewhere. However, there are an awful lot of connections between not just British intelligence and the supposed 7/7 bombers, the alleged bombers. And this is stuff that, to be fair, I don't think has got an awful lot of coverage in the alternative media and the truth movement and so on. For example, there is this guy, Mohammed Qayyum Khan. He is known as Q, the letter Q, like the guy in the James Bond films. He, according to testimony in court, he was responsible for sending the ringleader, the alleged ringleader, I should say, of the 7/7 plot, Mohammed Sadiq Khan. He sent him to Pakistan for training at a terrorist camp in 2003. Now, Q was also supposed to be the mastermind of the fertilizer bomb plot in Britain, which is this big terrorism case that happened around the same time. He was never arrested. He was never prosecuted in any way. He is now apparently living freely in the UK, getting on with his life. Why? Why was he never arrested? Now, this came up, actually, in a BBC documentary where one of their journalists, he asks a senior policeman, was he not arrested because he was working for MI5 or Special Branch or whoever? And the policeman almost panics in his response. I mean, I'll see if I can find the video for you, because people really have to see this. The policeman's response is so obvious that, you know, something's being covered up here. Something isn't being said. And he just sort of says, no, I'm not commenting on that kind of speculation. But he says it in such a way that it's rather obvious that this guy was an MI5 informant or a police informant or something.
Perhaps you could refresh our memory about the fertilizer bomb plot.
Well, this is a group based in Britain of seven men, ultimately. Well, eight, ultimately, because one of them was in Canada. They were arrested in August, I think, 2004. No, it was earlier than that. I think it was about April 2004. They had been under surveillance for a long time. They had this lockup with a big, you know, package of fertilizer in it that they were supposedly planning to use to either blow up the Ministry of Sound nightclub or blow up a shopping center. And as I say, the supposed ringleader of this plot, Mohammed Qayyum Khan, was never arrested, he was never interrogated, he's never suffered anything because of this investigation. And yet, there's seven others, they are put on trial. The main facilitator of this plot was a man called Omar Khayyam. He had been to a terrorism training camp in Kashmir as part of the ongoing, you know, India and Pakistan warring over Kashmir in 2000. He testified in court that this camp was being run by the Pakistani ISI. Then the following day, he says, I'm not answering any more questions to do with this case because the Pakistani ISI have warned my family that something horrible might happen to them if I continue. So once again, the trail leads back to an intelligence agency. We're talking about, you know, the supposed mastermind appears to be MI5. The main sort of facilitator and ringleader of the plot seems to have been trained by the ISI, and there are other reports saying other family members of his are ISI and so on and so forth. We also have another issue that Omar Khayyam also went to this training camp in Pakistan with Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the supposed ringleader of the 7/7 plot, in 2003. This camp appears to be the one that was set up by a guy called Mohammed Junaid Babar, who I assume you've come across, the Al-Qaeda supergrass, as he's known. He is another miscellaneous sort of jihadi, a miscellaneous mujahid, who became an FBI informant, or possibly was an FBI informant all along. He grew up in Pakistan. He grew up in America. He was born in Pakistan, grew up in America. He was part of Al-Muhajirun in America, which is connected to the Al-Qaeda and connected to the Maktab al-Khidmat and all of that stuff going on. He's in America on 9/11. His mother works on the ninth floor of the World Trade Center, I think, and then she escapes from it. Mohammed Babar is apparently so inspired by 9/11 that he goes off to Afghanistan to fight with the alongside the Taliban. He sets up a terrorist training camp. He supposedly provides money and equipment to Al-Qaeda. He returns to America 3 years later in 2004. He's arrested. He instantly becomes an FBI informant, and he testifies in various cases, including the fertilizer bomb plot case in this country. He testified in the other part of that trial in Canada. And he also testified in the trial of three men accused of helping the alleged 7/7 bombers. So he ties into an awful lot of this as well. And again, this is someone who, by all indications, was working for an intelligence agency as early as 2001. Not, he just got turned immediately on his arrest in 2004. So this policy continues, and out of this, we not only get terrorist attacks, like the World Trade Center bombing, and potentially 7/7, but what happened there is so unclear that I'm not going to speculate at this point, I think. But we also get terrorism cases. We get the trials. We get dozens and dozens of these apparently impressionable young Muslim men who have got involved with the wrong people. And by the wrong people, we're not saying radicalizers. We're not saying crazy Islamists with apocalyptic worldviews. We're talking about people who work for these very intelligence services that are supposed to be trying to stop this. So you've got to ask, what is this policy really worth? What are we accomplishing by it? Are we in fact only really accomplishing a system whereby we're prosecuting the results of our own making, of our own process? We are creating a threat for ourselves that doesn't need to be there. Because, and this is one of the things we were discussing in our emails, when we talk about the intelligence connections to the World Trade Center bombing, when we talk about the fact that, you know, the Blind Sheikh was the sort of ideological leader of the plot, if you like, there were all his followers that actually did the to-ing and fro-ing and the building of the bomb and, you know, carrying it out. Blind Sheikh was clearly, at least up to some extent, sponsored by the CIA. We talk about Ali Mohammed, who trained all these people, who was certainly a CIA agent for a period and perhaps for pretty much his whole career while he was in America. And we haven't even really covered Ramzi Youssef yet, who himself may have been recruited by the CIA and certainly seems to have had some protection from the Pakistani ISI in this period.
That's right, so again, and Youssef is such a central character. Maybe we should go back and just talk a little bit about him and his role in the bombing.
Okay. Ramzi Youssef is a born in Kuwait, Baluchistani. He's from that area, sort of in between Pakistan and Iran, that kind of belongs to both countries and is a bit of a volatile place because of it. He attended university in Wales, in the United Kingdom. He studied electrical engineering, but during the break between semesters, he goes off to Pakistan and trains in one of the various camps that they have there that, you know, they were using to prepare Mujahideen for the Afghan War. So he is at least peripherally involved in this kind of hostile, at times, liaison between our intelligence services and various sort of Islamic militants of different descriptions. However, if you read Richard Lebeviere's book, Dollars for Terror, he notes in an FBI file, which again remains classified and which none of us have seen as far as I know, that the FBI believe that at that point when Yousef was in Pakistan, he was recruited by the CIA. Now, we don't know whether that's true, but again, it's worthy of further investigation. This is, you know, why is this stuff still classified? Like you say, to a lot of people, they're not going to be all that surprised, but that doesn't make it right in any way. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be motivated to get these things into the public domain, because we really should be. Yousef, then, there is not many details on what exactly Yousef was doing in 1991 and 92, but after Imad Salem gets sacked by the FBI in the summer of 1992, after perhaps building some of this bomb we used on the World Trade Center, Ramzi Yousef is called in by the Blind Sheikh. It seems he placed a call to Yousef's affiliates in Pakistan and said, you know, we need a new bomber, we need somewhere else to build a bomb. And Yousef was an intelligent, talented young terrorist, if you like. He had a degree in electrical engineering. That's not that common a thing in young Muslim men, certainly in that period anyway. So he was, if you like, something of a rising star. He comes over to America in September 1992. The plot seems to gather momentum around this period, although whether that's people saying that it gathered momentum around this period because they like dressing up Yousef as this fantastic genius, you know, new Carlos the Jackal type, or whether that's actually just not true and the whole thing was going on anyway, is a little unclear. As you said, I mean, I've got hold of the 302s from the FBI's interrogation of Yousef when they eventually got hold of him 2 years later. And he said he only ever met the Blind Sheikh once, over dinner. Now, if the Blind Sheikh was running this whole plot, which a lot of people think he was, and which there is a reasonable amount of evidence he was, because, you know, he was around a lot longer than Yousef was, why did Yousef only ever meet him once? There is a bit of a question here as to how integrated this group really were.
But the phone records indicate that Yousef was in quite a bit of contact with him in the run-up to the bombing, wasn't he?
Yes, but it was, I mean, he only ever met him once face-to-face. And it would be curious if you're planning a terrorist attack to only ever meet the person who's ultimately sort of motivating people to do this, if you only ever met them once. So I don't know whether this is Yousef lying to try and keep the Blind Sheikh out of it, which is a possibility, of course. If the Blind Sheikh was as important to, quote-unquote, Al-Qaeda, as a lot of people think, then maybe Yousef was telling the FBI this as, you know, to try and contribute to the Blind Sheikh's efforts to free himself from prison. Because, of course, the point at which Yousef said these things is in 1995. That's 2 years later.
Right. Not to further complicate the story with more conspiracy theorizing, but for people who don't know what 302s are, perhaps we should talk a little bit about that, because that adds another level of complication to the idea that this is what Yousef actually said.
A 302 is essentially an FBI document that they use for recording any interrogation with a suspect, or even just with a witness. If they go and talk to someone about a phone call that they received, say, they will record what that person said in a 302, but crucially, it is written by the FBI agent, and therefore it is entirely, you know, reliant on how honest and sincere the FBI agent is in recording the truth, the sort of conversation in a truthful way. So we do have some problems with whether or not Yousef actually said these things. But they never recorded these conversations, so I suppose maybe that's something we'll never actually know.
Exactly. And that's just a ridiculous thing that I think a lot of people don't really understand about FBI investigations, and it's something that Janet Reno was questioned about repeatedly and just refused to answer about whether the FBI would ever consider you know, using recordings of interviews instead of handwritten notes that are then transcribed into memos by the agents themselves. But another extremely interesting part of the Youssef story comes from actually when he was in prison, and apparently between his cell and that of his accomplice, Murda? Was that his name?
Sorry, who?
Hakim
Murad.
Yes, Murad. Sorry, yes, Murad.
And the whole Bojinka plot and all of that.
Right, and apparently he was being held next to a mafia FBI informant by the name of Scarfa, I believe, who was helping to shuttle messages back and forth between Murad and Youssef. And apparently one of the things that they did was to try to hook him into this plot whereby they said they convinced him that there was a mafia organization called Roma Corporation that was going to patch his phone calls through to anywhere in the world. And of course the FBI was listening in, and through that apparently Youssef was making calls to his contacts in I'm not sure where he was calling, but he was speaking in Baluchi, which the FBI couldn't translate. And through that apparently he may have organized TWA 800, which is just a whole other area of things to explore.
Well, it is. I mean, TWA 800 is... it's an extremely complex one. I mean, forensically, it doesn't seem to make much sense that when a bomb goes off, when an explosion goes off, it generally leaves traces of the explosive, unexploded traces. Like, I mean, most bombs are a sort of jelly-like substance. They're soft. You know, you can... the classic plastic explosive that you can push your thumb into. So when they explode, little bits of that go flying off away from the explosion that don't actually detonate, that don't actually, you know, ignite and do anything. And this is how, generally, when you explore a bombing, this is how you try and initially determine what the bomb was made of, and that should lead you on to who made it, where, so on and so forth. In TWA 800, I think the tests came back with three different types of explosive residue were found on parts of the aeroplane after it had been, you know, dredged up from underneath the water and reconstructed. They found traces of three different types of explosive, which is rare to the point of being almost bizarre, because normally you would use two types of explosive. You use one in the detonator, which normally would be entirely consumed in detonating, and you use one for the main charge. So where they got three from is a real mystery. And in fact, that brings us back to another point about the World Trade Center bombing, is that in the investigation of the underground parking lot and all the evidence that they had down there, they never actually found any traces of explosive. They never found any chemical residues that they then tested to establish that this was what the bomb was made of. The testimony that came in court on the part of the prosecutors was, it seems, entirely based on one FBI forensic investigator wandering around the scene and making estimates based on the sort of the amount of damage done as to how big the explosion was and what had caused it, which isn't a very forensic method.
Right, and as a matter of fact, that relates back to the FBI whistleblower, Frederick Whitehurst, who was working in the FBI forensic lab, who said that there was no sound scientific basis for concluding that there was a urea nitrate bomb used as the source of the explosion.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, because they did find traces of chemicals. They found unused chemicals, in fact, and they found traces of chemical processes in the apartment where Youssef and Abu Halima and the others apparently built this bomb. So
I think Dr. Whitehurst's point at the time was that there was broken sewer pipes and that contaminated the scene in a way to bias the test towards indicating a positive for the urea nitrate. And I believe he famously peed in a jar and gave two samples to one was explosive and one was his urine. And he gave those two samples to a lab and asked them to sort out which was which. And
yeah, you're certainly right about that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Whitehurst I think I'm just saying that's a little bit of an exaggeration to say there's no evidence for it being a urea nitrate bomb. There is some evidence, but the processes by which the FBI forensically investigated that bombing were disgraceful. I mean, and the testimony that I think the guy in court was called David Williams, perhaps. He was claiming all sorts of things that weren't true. He said that they had reconstructed a sort of equivalent size bomb using a recipe that they'd found in a notebook belonging to one of the suspects. So they are saying, you know, from the tests that we carried out on our own explosion, we can establish that the damage could have been caused and so on and so forth. And this is what he's standing up in court and saying. Now, the Department of Justice investigated this, and in their report they say, in fact, none of this is true, that he didn't actually carry out a test explosion using that recipe. He wasn't involved in that part of the investigation. A replica bomb was constructed, but it wasn't using the recipe found in the notebook, and it had nothing to do with this guy from the FBI. It was done by other people. So he was just fabricating evidence. So Whitehurst is certainly correct about that. And that, again, not this story is becoming very complicated, but of course, you know, all the roads interconnect. But this leads us again to Lockerbie. It's the same people that were in the FBI lab investigating the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. They're the same people that are in the FBI lab investigating Lockerbie in 1989. And there are all sorts of problems with that case, because it has now emerged that certain key evidence in that case was connected to Libya by people who were paid by the FBI for their testimony. So once you get into this, I suppose the key issue is it's never entirely certain who carried out these terrorist attacks. And so we may want to say World Trade Center 1993 was some kind of state-sponsored attack by America on itself. That probably isn't true, because I don't think it was deliberate. That said, because the forensics are so kind of roughshod, and because there are so many different contradictions in the different accounts of this, and problems with the sort of reliability of the evidence that we're talking about here, that it is possible, ultimately, that Ramzi Youssef, Mohamed Salameh, Mahmoud Abu Halima, the Blind Sheikh, and so on, didn't actually bomb the World Trade Center in 1993. It's possible. It's unlikely. But so, in terms of drawing a conclusion, we can only really go with the kind of weight of evidence. You know, you stick everything together and you say, where does this lean to? And I would say, I'd actually agree with, you brought it up earlier, the CIA said, to a certain extent, we bombed our own World Trade Center because we funded these people, we helped train them, we helped equip them, we helped prepare them to do this. But they were talking in terms of blowback. They weren't talking in terms of a deliberate sponsorship by the CIA to make this happen. They're saying, we got involved with these people for various different motives. That relationship came back to haunt us. It was not intentional that these people went out and bombed the World Trade Center, although in some respects it was kind of useful that they did. But nonetheless, the CIA were involved up to a point on the weight of evidence again. And so we are probably talking about a blowback scenario. I would agree with, at least as it's reported in the Boston Herald article, the CIA report where they say that's their assessment of what happened with the World Trade Center in 1993. But it isn't certain. It isn't certain.
Well, again, we are looking at the preponderance of evidence because we are staring at a hall of mirrors, smoke and mirrors, and it's almost impossible to actually discern what information we can rely on and what to what extent it's been doctored or filtered. So it is an extremely difficult thing to do, and it is, I think you're right to bring attention to the complexity of this case, because it shows that we shouldn't be too quick to form an easy narrative of these types of things, because quite often when we do so, we're staggeringly wrong about it. Like when we get simple facts and details about the Ahmad Salem case wrong, we thereby do the entire story injustice, and we run the risk of being consigned to the crazy kook conspiracy theorist category because we're not doing our basic homework. So you are obviously someone who has done the homework on this and has studied quite a bit of detail on these types of attacks. So I'm sure my listeners are interested to know a little bit more about yourself and how you came to start researching this, and whether you have a website or working on any documentary or anything of that sort. So anything you'd like to say in that regard?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was one of those people who, on 9/11, was sat there thinking, something doesn't quite add up here. You know, you've seen, over about the period of an hour and a half, 2 hours, we have apparently seen 4 planes hit 3 targets and 1 crash into a field, supposedly hijacked. Now, straight away, plenty of people were asking, where was the military response? Where were the interceptors? Where were the, you know, fighter jets screaming through the skies to take these planes out? Then we have the World Trade Center falling down, disintegrating. Plenty of people, the first time they saw that, thought, not quite right. Doesn't look like how you would imagine a structural collapse should take place. Too quick, so on and so forth. So I suppose that was one of the key moments at which I thought, some of this stuff isn't adding up, and it needs to be looked at more closely. And obviously, over time, with the growth of the 9/11 truth movement, there's tons of research going on into what really happened there, and, or at least certainly what could have been happening there. And I'm not a member of any 9/11 truth group. I'm not part of that whole campaign. That's not really why I'm interested in this. I'm interested to try and understand more about the policy, to try and understand more about the decisions that have clearly been made by officials at various times that have led to these things happening, the grand context, if you like. The individual cases are often too hard to establish exactly, it's often too hard to establish exactly what's happened, that you could come to any conclusion and you'll find some degree of evidence for it, like the 9/11 Commission did. Doesn't mean it's true. So what interests me and what motivates me and what my research primarily focuses on is how this policy, starting in roughly 1979 and carrying on apparently through to the present day, has affected the nature of our security, not just in terms of we've sponsored people who've then come back to do something horrible to us, blowback scenario, but also the more deliberate, intentional, have we actually made people carry out terrorist attacks on us as an excuse to react? The sort of Gladio scenario, Operation Gladio scenario, or the sort of thing that's discussed in P2OG. You're familiar with P2OG, I take it.
Absolutely. I forget what it stands for.
Preemptive Proactive Operations Group.
That's it.
Something like that.
Yes.
Which again talked about deliberately stimulating terrorists to do things in order that we can respond to it. This policy is real. On 9/11, I was too young, too ignorant, too distracted by other things, to be honest, to really know that. But in the course of the, I don't know, near decade or so that's followed, if you set out to ask that question and to try and find the evidence for it and try and find some kind of answer for it, you find that this policy does actually clearly take place, at least some of the time. I'm not saying every single terrorist attack involving Muslims is some kind of state-sponsored thing, but a lot of them are. And certainly the really big ones quite often are. So I suppose I see my role just as someone who's trying to get more information and someone who's trying to identify the points at which more declassification, more publication of documents and so forth is most critical. Because you can get bogged down in questions about what sort of explosive might have been used to blow up the World Trade Center, either in 1993 or in 2001. You can get bogged down in questions of, you know, how many bombs were used in Oklahoma City in 1995. I don't know if we'll ever get answers to those questions, because the forensic evidence is all gone. So what remains is the policy of sponsoring terrorists, either directly or indirectly, either intentionally or accidentally. And that's something we can uncover, because in these reports, in these documents, in these 302s, in all of them, you find the details. You find little hints and clues that, when you fit it together, become confirmation. They become evidence of, if you want to call it a conspiracy, call it a conspiracy, but certainly of an open complicity between the very people that are supposed to be protecting us and the people that they are supposedly fighting against. So yeah, this is what I do. I mean, you asked about work, the things that I'm working on. I do actually have a documentary that's in the very final stages of being put together that should be available online within a matter of days, really. That's all to do with 7-7, that goes into a lot of these relationships, a lot of this complicity, a lot of these apparent state sponsorship. It doesn't particularly put forth any conclusion about 7-7, because, like I say, I think the individual events themselves, it may be too hard to ever do that, and you run the risk of overstepping what evidence you do have, and, like you say, being labelled a kook and a crackpot and a conspiracy theorist and all the rest of it. So what I've tried to do in this documentary is take that event, 7-7, the London bombings, and put it into this context and analyse what we've been told about this in that context, if you see what I mean. And, I mean, as soon as it's available, I'll email and let you know, and you can stick up a link to it or whatever you want to do.
Well, that is fascinating, and I am looking forward to it. Do you have a title for this yet?
Not absolutely, so I'll let you know
okay.
on that front.
Well, I will certainly pass that along to the listeners, and when you send that link, I'll put it up in the documentation section for today's interview, so people in the future who are listening sometime in the future can go and check that out. And I'm sure everyone will be interested in it, because you certainly do have a lot of information apparently on these subjects. You don't have a blog or anything that you keep up to date?
I do. I have a blog. It's called Howard Beale's News Hour. Do you know the character Howard Beale from the movie Network?
Yes, of course.
Movie
right.
Network? Sort of loosely
mad as hell,
that.
And I'm not going to take it anymore.
A bit, yeah. So if people want to, you know, see what else I've got to say, they can go there and take a look at it.
Absolutely. Well, I didn't even know that myself, so I think I'll do that right away. Well, Tom Secker, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I feel like we've really only just scratched the surface, because there is so much detail to go into, so hopefully we can have you on again in the future to talk in more detail about some of these cases. But at any rate, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.